Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's program is supported by Ono Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And just delighted to have you all on board. I would just like to say that we are very happy to have all of you on board here today. And today's program is made possible by Ono Pharmaceuticals, and we really want to thank them for their support of today's program. I want to acknowledge that our funders for today's program are Ono Pharmaceuticals Company, LTD, and I really want to thank them for their support. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Alvaro Alanzar. Dr. Alanzar is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine, Chief Medical Officer, Cancer Center Member, Lymphoma Committee at Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, Hematology Section Lead, Sylvester Cancer Global Oncology Program. And Dr. Alcara will be addressing overview of primary central nervous system lymphoma, PCNSL, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Alanzar.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for the kind introduction, and thank you so much for the invitation to be back to a Cancer Care teleconference. It's such an important opportunity that we have to discuss with patients and family members, the management of these challenging diseases. So I was asked to talk a little bit about an overview of primary central nervous system lymphoma. So primary CNS lymphoma, as we commonly describe, is a cancer of the immune system. It's a lymphoma. It's a cancer of our immune system that happens to involve the central nervous system. So it is a brain cancer. You can call it a brain cancer, but it's a unique type of brain cancer, which is a cancer of the immune system happening in the brain. And it's not only the brain. We have different compartments in our central nervous system, the brain itself, also the fluid that surrounds the brain, the cerebrospinal fluid or CSF, the lining that is along the brain or the meninges, and all the spine and the spinal roots that come from the brain, and also the eyes. Interestingly, the involvement of lymphoma inside the eyes can also be considered a compartment. We all call these different compartments of this disease that we call primary central nervous system lymphoma. When we diagnose this disease, the first thing that we try to understand is whether this is really a disease of only the central nervous system, or it is a secondary involvement of a lymphoma that happens in the remainder of the body and is also involved in the brain. The reason we do that is because the therapy is very different. In primary central nervous system lymphomas, while rarely can have some disease outside the central nervous system, categorically, it is a disease of the central nervous system alone. As I mentioned, it's a cancer of the lymphatic system, of the immune system, and it is a disease that is frequently related with immune dysfunction or conditions in which there's problems with the immune system. So you can have the disease in patients that have autoimmune disorders, patients that have immune suppressed conditions, as for example, HIV patients. The incidence tends to increase as patients age and the immune system does not function really well. But obviously, you can also have the disease in younger patients without any immune dysfunction and without really a clear relationship with this immune suppressed state. So, but it is a disease of the brain, and when we're treating the disease, we are focusing on therapies that are able to target the brain and these other compartments. Why do I say that? Because our brain has what is called the blood-brain barrier. It's an important barrier that blocks and protects our brain from invaders like viruses and bacteria, but also from drugs. Not every drug that we use to treat diseases in the rest of the body will have activity inside the brain. So we have to use specific drugs that will penetrate this barrier. And one of the main drugs for that is a chemotherapy agent called methotrexate. I'm saying chemotherapy because this is a disease that is mainly treated with these chemotherapy agents, with these systemic agents. Primary brain lymphoma, primary CNS lymphoma does not have an incredible role, or surgery does not have an incredible role in this disease. We use biopsies, we use surgery to confirm the diagnosis, but removing the lesions in general is not really very beneficial. In addition to these chemotherapies, systemic therapies, we will also use radiation therapy on occasion, and we also use as another important weapon in our options to treat the disease, an intense approach with higher dose of chemotherapy that is called a bone marrow transplant. We're not trying to replace the marrow, we're just trying to allow us to use higher doses of chemotherapy to make up some cells that, or address some cells that might have survived the standard doses of chemo, and then we need to replace the marrow with new stem cells because this high dose of chemo will really eliminate the patient's bone marrow. Therapy is very complex. It's going to be a lot of times a combination of these options, and we will tailor the therapy according to what the patient can tolerate, and that can be based on different function of the bodies and how good our all the organs like heart and kidneys and lungs are working, how functional the patients are, and also their age will also end up having an important role. We know all these options and all these strategies to treat lymphoma because of clinical trials. And I was asked to really talk about the role of clinical trials in CNS lymphoma, and it is really a critical aspect of how we treat lymphoma today and how we're going to treat lymphoma in the future. A lot of what we have done is, what we do today is based on trials that were done in the past, and what we're going to do in the future will be led by trials that we conduct today. So it is extremely important to have studies to understand how to use these drugs better, understand how the disease behaves. We're having more and more modern drugs that target specific targets or specific pathways along the cancer cell, and we need to have clinical trials to understand how to use these therapies better. So it is impossible for us to improve the care of lymphoma without clinical trials, and we strongly encourage, whenever possible, that care for lymphoma be done under a clinical trial. So it is something that is important for the patient that is in front of us as we're providing the cutting edge, the best therapy that we have available today, but also helping future patients as it helps us understand and advance the field. Clinical trials obviously have sometimes a difficult connotation that patients may feel like they are called, as people frequently will say, a guinea pig, and it's far, far, far from that. It is really, clinical trials are the best way to receive therapy. You have a multidisciplinary team that is watching carefully what is happening, overlooking you, and no drug will get you a clinical trial without a reasonable track record to make sure it is at least similar to what is currently available, potentially better. So this is a very quick overview. There's a lot more that we can talk, and we have fantastic speakers that are going to go deeper into it. The idea was more to lay the foundation for primary CNS lymphoma and the critical aspect of clinical trials. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Alencar. That was just an amazing presentation, really so comprehensive. And also, the way that you have presented this overview is so important. for our participants and for everyone on the call. And of course, the importance of clinical trials is so very important in moving forward with cancer treatment. So, and I think we'll talk more about that throughout the program. Thank you so very much for your presentation. I really, really appreciate it very much. And our next presenter is Dr. Jean Jia Ruan. And Dr. Ruan is professor of clinical medicine, Weill Cornell Medicine, Lymphoma Program, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology. And Dr. Ruan will be addressing how research increases your treatment options and managing symptoms and treatment side effects. It's my pleasure now to bring on my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ruan. Dr. Ruan.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Dr. Messner, for the invitation, and thank you, CancerCare, for providing this great opportunity to share our experience and have a discussion with the patient and also with my esteemed colleagues here who have a lot of experience of treating CNS lymphoma. So to address this topic, which is how research increases treatment options and how we manage symptoms and side effects, you know, I wanted to just follow right along what Dr. Alan Carr has provided for this very nice background. So our goal for treatment of CNS lymphoma is to provide timely treatment to alleviate symptoms related to this condition and achieve remission whenever feasible. And very importantly, we want to preserve and hopefully improve the quality of life of our patients by, you know, continue to come up with a better treatment with better efficacy, effectiveness, and also to minimize side effects. I want to start by, you know, discussing about treatment of patients who have this new diagnosis of CNS lymphoma. The initial treatment generally, you know, can include two stages. First is a induction treatment with a goal to achieve remission, and the second is to try to maintain that response by doing consolidation or other maintenance option to prevent this disease from coming back. As what Dr. Alan Carr just alluded earlier, that the backbone of treatment for primary CNS lymphoma is this high-dose methotrexate, which is anti-folic acid medication that has a very unique property that it can get into our, you know, privileged central nervous system compartment. And we also combine that with the antibody called rituximab. It's attacking the CD20 positive B cell, which is present on the primary CNS lymphoma. And with research, you know, over the years, we also learned to add additional effective chemotherapeutic agents and other novel agents to the combination. And the requirement for high-dose methotrexate is that we must carefully assess making sure that the patient have a good kidney function and a reasonable performance status, which is the general well-being physical status. Certainly, we apply modification to this treatment approach to make sure that we can deliver treatment effectively and also safely. So I thought maybe I'll just go over a few commonly considered treatment options and pointing out how our research over the years have really enriched our options and certainly more that could be done with developing new trials and clinical research. So I want to start with something called a regimen called methotrexate-temozolomide-rituximab, MTR, which is a induction regimen that consists of high-dose methotrexate, as we discussed earlier, another agent, oral agent, temozolomide, and this anti-CD20 antibody rituximab. It is generally considered for patients with good, in fact, solid and robust kidney function and having reasonably good physical health and performance status. I wanted to point out that this regimen is in fact developed with a lot of efforts from clinical trial, starting with a trial called Alliance CLGB 50202 study that it studied this triple combinations in patients, and which looks to be rather effective. About three quarters patient achieving remission, and the duration are actually quite promising. Following up on that, another trial, which is called Alliance 51101 study, was just recently reported that bring this combination a step further and, assess could we improve that by adding a stem cell transplant at the end for those patients who completed and with good response to that. I like this combination because it really provides a good range of options for our patient. Using the high-dose methotrexate and rituximab, and then for those who actually are having a good response, to further bring them into a consolidation phase with autologous stem cell transplant. How do we, address some of the treatment side effects? It is really need to be, addressed with very careful monitoring, because methotrexate interferes with folic metabolism, and we want, the treatment to get to our patient at the right therapeutic level. We also don't want methotrexate to linger, and for that reason, we would have patients to be monitored very carefully in the hospital for very adequate fluid hydrations. We monitor kidney functions and proper clearance. We also provide a medication called leucovorin, which is a similar antifolate to compete to protect normal cells and from excessive side effects. And we also monitor them for other functions like liver function, bone marrow and things like that. The second regimen is we use quite a bit in our treatment care is another combination called MPV, so methotrexate, rituximab with other combination, including procarbazine and vincristine. And those are for patients who, generally have good kidney function but not candidate for consolidation. And again, we would we learned about this combination based on a trial that was conducted a while ago at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and we very similarly monitoring side effects by having patients monitored in the hospital setting for hydrations and providing another agent, leucovorin, after giving patient high-dose methotrexate. Finally, with chemotherapy-based backbone treatment using high-dose methotrexate, we also using this regimen called Matrix, which is actually high-dose methotrexate, rituximab, but adding additional agent called cytarabine and xylotepa. We generally consider this combination for younger patients because of the treatment-related side effects, especially the pressure on the bone marrow, blood counts. And I want to point it out that, this combination was studied very extensively, in fact, in randomized studies conducted by the International Extranodal Lymphoma Society, comparing, the multi-agent combination with the three-drug combination and two-drug combination. This combination, eventually shown to be the best in terms of response rate and response duration. And obviously, we have to choose proper patient, making sure that it's effective, but also being very safe by monitoring blood counts and providing infection prevention prophylaxis. And finally, as what Dr. Alan Carr also alluded to, that we in fact are looking into not chemotherapy-based treatment with targeted biological agents. I want to very quickly mention two of such agents. One of them has been used and also in clinical trial is a proton tyrosine kinase inhibitor called ibrutinib. That is a oral medication and has been used in other settings, but now has been looked into treatment of primary CNS lymphoma as a single agent as well as in combination. One such combination has also been studied in clinical trial is called TEDI-R. With this new agent, we also are looking into how to provide supportive care, monitoring side effects, such as watching for cardiovascular parameters and watching for other side effects like effect on bruising and gastrointestinal aspect as well. The next novel agent that I consider also for our patient either after chemo induction treatment or for those who may have some recurrent disease is a immune modulatory compound called lenalidomide. This has been used as one drug agent, but also in combination with rituximab. I wanted to mention that in fact, many of the panelists here are really very instrumental in doing clinical trials and bring those to our clinical practice. For example, the previous MTR combination, Dr. Rubenstein, Dr. Batchelor has done the Alliance study, and here with lenalidomide, Dr. Rubenstein's group actually worked on this to evaluate the effectiveness in patients and understanding what kind of side effects that we must pay attention to, such as prevention, prevention with aspirin, monitoring blood counts, and monitoring gastrointestinal side effects as well. Very lastly, there are currently ongoing trials for patients who might need additional treatment, some of which include novel immunotherapy such as CAR T cells, as well as antibody like bispecific antibody. So I think overall, our options are certainly increasing. And with a lot of work that putting from coming up with clinical trials and participating in clinical trial for CNS lymphoma. I want to again thank you for the invitation, and I hope that this very brief overview shares some of our experience of taking care of patients with CNS lymphoma. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Dr. Yuen, your presentation was really wonderful, and I have to say that that the issue of treatment side effect management and the newer treatments that are out there are so important for patients to hear about. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Tracy Batchelor, and Dr. Batchelor is neurologist in chief and chair, Department of Neurology, Brigham and Women's Hospital, co-chair, Mass General Brigham Neurology, Martin A. Samuels Professor of Neurology, Harvard Medical School, and co-leader Neuro-Oncology Program, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Dana-Farber Cancer Center. And Dr. Bashful will be addressing discomfort and quality of life concerns and key questions to ask your healthcare team. It's really my great pleasure now to introduce my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bashful.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and it's really just a pleasure for me to join my colleagues today to talk with you about primary CNS lymphoma. And as mentioned, I've been asked to cover three areas: quality of life, discomfort that patients may experience during this journey with lymphoma, and to end with some questions that one should think about asking their provider. And I thought I would break this down as follows. I'm going to start with quality of life and discomfort issues that revolve around the diagnosis and some of the diagnostic procedures and tests, and then move on to talk a little bit about tumor-related issues with respect to quality of life and discomfort, and then some of the treatment-related issues. So we'll start with the diagnosis. So as has been mentioned, the diagnosis of a primary CNS lymphoma is typically done by a neurosurgeon via a brain biopsy. And this is an inpatient operation. It requires anesthesia in most cases. Fortunately, the complication rate is very low, under 5% with this procedure. And most individuals who have a brain biopsy are discharged from the hospital 2 to 5 days after the event. There certainly can be some discomfort around the incision site. There can be some swelling, but all of that will improve with time, and patients are encouraged to really follow the surgeon's instructions about all the wound healing and care that's required. There are several other diagnostic tests that are typically done. And one of them is a spinal tap, or something we call a lumbar puncture, and that's done in most individuals, and that's to determine whether the lymphoma has involvement of the spinal fluid. Typically, this is an outpatient procedure, and it involves really only a local anesthetic to the skin itself. There could be some local discomfort at the time of the procedure, but that tends to be minor. A small percentage of patients will develop after the procedure something we call a low pressure or spinal tap headache. And the characteristic feature of that is that it gets worse when sitting up or standing and improves or resolves when lying flat. That usually will go away in a few days, but if it does not, there's a very effective outpatient procedure called a blood patch that can be done to alleviate that headache. There are radiology tests that are necessary to make sure there's no lymphoma elsewhere in the body. These include CAT scans, PET scans, MRI scans. Brain MRI scans will be repeated many times to monitor progress during treatment. These scans are typically given with an intravenous contrast agent so that the radiologist can better visualize the lymphoma in the brain. There's minimal pain associated with this procedure except for the placement of an IV for the contrast. However, the MRI can be difficult for individuals who have claustrophobia. So we have typically encourage those patients to pre-medicate before an MRI, about a half an hour before, with a medication like Valium or Ativan. Or it is also possible to use an MRI scanner that has a larger bore so that it's less claustrophobic. Not all facilities have those. You have to ask for them. MRI scans also typically evoke anxiety in all cancer patients, as it's a real key test, and it's used to determine if the tumor is responding, has entered remission, or has grown back. As has been alluded to earlier, an eye examination is necessary to make sure there's no lymphoma in the eye. There's really no discomfort with this. This should be done by an experienced ophthalmologist, not an optometrist, but an experienced ophthalmologist who can examine all compartments of the eye. Sometimes the doctors also recommend a bone marrow biopsy, which should be done before treatment. That's becoming less common, but sometimes it is recommended. That can cause some local pain and discomfort, but that can be, again, mitigated by use of a local anesthetic. Sometimes also we recommend that an individual have neuropsychological testing before starting treatment. This is done with a psychologist, and this allows us to have a good baseline assessment of cognitive function before starting any treatments. And this can take a few hours, but it can provide your provider with another marker to determine whether the treatment is successful or to pick up side effects from the treatment in the future. So those are all the diagnosis-related issues around discomfort, quality of life. Now I want to turn to some of the tumor-related issues, because when there is a tumor in the brain, the location of the tumor really determines all of the symptoms and the signs that are expressed in someone. For example, a tumor in what we call the dominant hemispheres, which are the frontal and temporal lobes, and typically that's the left side of the brain in most individuals, that's where language resides. And so a tumor in that particular area of the brain could impact language. A tumor in something called the occipital lobe may impact vision. A tumor in the back part of the brain, the cerebellum, may impair balance, et cetera, et cetera. So depending on where the tumor is in the brain, you'll have a different set of neurological symptoms and signs. The good news is that these symptoms and signs will improve if the treatment begins to work and the tumors start to shrink. Sometimes we need additional help from our colleagues in physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy, which can also really help with the improvement of neurological symptoms. Seizures may occur when there's a tumor in the brain, and this may require treatment with an anti-seizure medicine. Very important to follow this schedule of treatment with an anti-seizure medicine 100%. It's really important not to miss any doses and to really closely follow the recommendations of your provider about the anti-seizure medicine and potential interactions with other medications that you may be on. Also, if a seizure has occurred, there may be laws in your state about driving restrictions, and these do vary from state to state, so you really do have to check with your provider. Now I want to switch gears and talk a bit about the treatment-related issues, and we've heard several talks now about chemotherapy. And one of the more important drugs, methotrexate, it's an older, but it's an effective drug. Because it has to be given at such high doses, one has to be in the hospital for 3 to 5 days to receive intravenous fluids to really protect the kidneys during treatment with methotrexate. One can be discharged once the blood level of methotrexate drops below a certain threshold. Sometimes patients during this treatment will feel nausea. Rarely, there might be some vomiting. Some patients develop diarrhea. There's sometimes some mouth sores associated with it and fatigue. But that being said, by giving anti-nausea medications, intravenous fluids, and other medications, one can hopefully minimize those symptoms of methotrexate. As mentioned, one of the main risks is around the kidneys, and so you'll have multiple blood and urine tests to really track kidney function and the methotrexate levels and determine really when you might be ready for that next dose of methotrexate, because we like to give a dose every 2 to 3 weeks as the tumor is responding. Also, blood counts, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets must be followed during chemotherapy. There are some rare side effects of methotrexate and some of the other chemotherapy drugs that your provider will certainly go over with you. The good news is almost all of the other chemotherapy drugs outside of the methotrexate can be given on an outpatient basis, so you don't have to be in the hospital for them. There are circumstances when there's lymphoma in the eye or lymphoma in the spinal fluid when chemotherapy must be given directly into the eye fluid by an ophthalmologist or into the spinal fluid by an oncologist or a neurologist. Again, these are outpatient procedures, and with proper preparation, the discomfort around these are really minimized. Radiation has been mentioned, and this is sometimes given at the time of the initial diagnosis or if lymphoma relapses and comes back later. The type of radiation that we have to give is known as whole brain radiation, covering all the areas of the brain. And this is typically given daily, Monday through Friday, for 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the dose and schedule. There's typically no pain or discomfort during the radiation, although sometimes there can be some brain swelling, and we might have to use a medication like a steroid to reduce that during the radiation. That's very manageable. One of the more concerning side effects of the radiation, whole brain radiation, is delayed cognitive impairment, which typically develops some months or a year or more after treatment and can negatively impact quality of life if it is severe. And in some cases, it can gradually worsen and there can be dementia. So we really take radiation very seriously. This is why we tend to defer it until the time of the tumor grows back, or we are now looking at lower doses of radiation. Hopefully these will come with lower risks of cognitive impairment. And I'm going to skip down and just now talk about some questions to think about asking your provider at the time of these various diagnostic procedures or during treatment with chemotherapy or radiation. So first, ask your treatment team about what you're actually going to feel and what you're going to experience in each of these phases of management: diagnosis, the chemotherapy drugs, the radiation if applicable, and a bone marrow transplant, if applicable. Ask about how the diagnosis and treatment might impact you at each phase of the treatment, and specifically how it might impact life functions such as sleep, diet, exercise, employment, social interactions, et cetera. It's important to understand the timeline of treatment and how you might need to adjust your work and personal schedules during the treatment phases. Also ask about the possibility of potentially going on leave or disability during your treatment, because sometimes that is necessary in the intensive periods of treatment. Ask about expenses that you might be expected to cover with these treatments. Consulting a treatment team member or your insurance company can avoid surprises and help you better understand any financial implications. There's a growing awareness of something called financial toxicity in oncology, where individuals and families receive very high bills. So it's very important to understand this up front. Ask about side effects of all treatments and what these side effects will have in terms of your quality of life. And finally, ask about the recovery period from each of these treatments and what you can expect to feel. When can you resume normal activities? When can you drive again? When might you expect to go back to work? There are other questions that certainly one will come up and you'll need to ask, but I'll stop there and I'll turn it back over to the team.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Batchelor. That was a wonderful presentation. And really, you did cover some very important issues around quality of life for people, things that people need to be concerned about, and also in terms of questions to ask the healthcare team. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. James Rubenstein. And Dr. Rubenstein is a professor of medicine, attending physician in hematology oncology, University of California, San Francisco. member UCF Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Rubenstein will be addressing guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology and prepared list of questions and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Rubenstein.
Thank you for the introduction. It's a great honor and pleasure to participate in this conference and notably to participate with my esteemed colleagues on the East Coast. So I've been asked to speak about key issues with preparation for telehealth visits in primary CNS lymphoma and the issues that are germane to primary CNS lymphoma and open notes issues that arise as patients review data from their visits and clinical results. So as has been elegantly outlined by the prior speakers, primary CNS lymphoma is a treatable disease, and the cornerstone of treatment includes a drug called high-dose methotrexate. It's important to note that this is an aggressive brain tumor, but it can be treated effectively and often cured. So it's important to know that that is a tangible goal of our therapy. And not only is cure possible, but marked neurologic improvement can be expected. One of the main issues when patients are newly diagnosed and they encounter this diagnosis and receive the first information about the extent of the disease and the location is to hear about the complex treatment, which has been described previously. This is a disease in which we normally will treat in two phases, as has been described, an induction phase and then a consolidation phase, and often followed by a maintenance phase. And this is distinct from systemic lymphomas, in which in most cases, there's just a set of repeat administrations of systemically administered chemotherapy, and then the treatment is over. So it's important to note that in primary CNS lymphoma, the treatment goes on perhaps for 6 or 7 months. The induction phase can take up to 4 months. Oftentimes, I find it difficult for patients to comprehend all the treatment steps that are need to be prescribed, and I wait at their first visit. And so they may anticipate that the first visit may just focus on the immediate staging, which has been outlined by Dr. Batchelor, as well as the initial treatment with high-dose methotrexate, which, as been described, usually involves inpatient hospitalization because of the management with fluids. So the key issues with high-dose methotrexate, as has been described, are preventing kidney injury and prolonged alkalinization. I always tell patients the good news is that high-dose methotrexate doesn't really have many of the very toxic side effects that systemic chemotherapy has, such as hair loss or bone marrow suppression, which can lead to infection. In fact, many of the patients tolerate it well, so I feel like many times the biggest side effect after the first administration or so is that the patient is boredom. They're stuck in the hospital and have to have repeat blood draws and ongoing fluid administration to facilitate the excretion of the methotrexate from the body, as well as mitigate toxicities with the drug leucovorin, which has been described before. And this can go on, this repeat administration can go on for 8 cycles often, and this can last up to 4 months. We call this the induction phase. And many times, there's marked neurologic improvement and marked functional improvement, so such that patients are better able to tolerate the next phases of treatment and better able to comprehend the toxicities of the next phases of treatment. Most commonly, consolidation consists of a myeloablative therapy or bone marrow transplant, which basically is just increased doses of cytotoxic chemotherapy, which have good brain penetration. The strategy is based upon the principle that repeat administration of high-dose methotrexate, while very effective, is in most cases not likely curative. So it's important to note that when you give methotrexate, it may ultimately lead to the emergence of chemotherapy-resistant cells. This is analogous to what happens if you have an infection. You keep giving the same antibiotic over and over again. If you have a repeated urinary infection, for example, you give penicillin repeatedly. What happens? You get penicillin-resistant bacteria. The same principle is likely true in cancer chemotherapy. Methotrexate is a fantastically effective drug, but in most cases not curable. Even though the MRI looks like the disease is in remission, we know there's likely small amounts of residual tumor or minimal residual disease. And this can, we think this can be eradicated definitively by the administration of different drugs that have different, work differently, kill cancer cells in a different way, and can get rid of the residual remaining tumor cells that are maybe responsible for recurrence. So in this way, we've shown that this disease can be cured by proceeding through an induction and a consolidation phase, but they have different side effects. And the side effects of consolidation generally are much more profound in terms of effects on the blood counts, effects on the bone marrow. Patients can have low blood counts for 7 to 10 days or longer, and this can increase the risk of the most significant side effect of chemotherapy, which is infection or sepsis, which can be life-threatening. And when if done in an outpatient setting, oftentimes may be fatal. So the patients during the consolidation phase, just like the induction phase, generally are managed in the inpatient setting to so that doctors can intervene early during the infection and with antibiotics and growth factor shots to stimulate the blood count to come back. So it's important to note that the consolidation phase does have life-threatening toxicities. So I always try to counsel patients that this two-step approach is a lot of information, and we're going to repeat the toxicity side effect profile as the therapeutic course is proceeds. There's also a role, we believe, for maintenance therapy to prevent lymphoma from coming back. And it can involve biological agents such as lenalidomide that administered at low doses seems to be well tolerated, and in patients that can't get consolidation because of organ dysfunction or age, lenalidomide seems to be associated with a prolongation of remission duration in many patients. The radiation has also been described as a salvage or as a therapeutic option, and I certainly agree with my colleagues who've identified and described as toxicities, which are likely dose-dependent and time-dependent and age-dependent. And we tend to delay the use of radiation until absolutely necessary. But I think it's important to note that this is a disease, when patients are diagnosed, that this is a disease that can be treated, it can be cured, and while they initially present within a very impaired state in terms of memory or neurologic functional status, we can anticipate marked neurologic improvement. And this improvement can take weeks to months to even years to realize. So many times patients, it's important to note that patients recover from their tumor, but they still have some deficits. And this doesn't mean that these deficits are permanent. Many times it's important to emphasize the potential for cognitive rehab, both formally with a psychologist or informally, which can be done at home. I often mention this to patients that when their functional status improves, there's evidence that physical exercise, especially getting the heart rate up, can improve neurologic recovery and improve the function of neurons in the brain, even after chemotherapy or the tumor. Or things that can be done at home to improve neurologic status, which we're all engaged in all the time, but there's evidence that's been recommended by psychologists that reading, performing games or performing puzzles, as well as exercise, can contribute to neurocognitive recovery as well. So it's important that to note that this is a treatable disease and a neurologic recovery can be realized both by eradicating the tumor and by exercising the brain through these approaches. In terms of open notes, one of the biggest and most reproducible challenges I encounter as a physician is patients are often have concerns about what their MRI report looks like. Their MRIs are complicated imaging techniques, which are based upon looking at basically the water and proton content in the brain and under the variables of MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, this can provide very detailed information about the tissue structure in the brain. And so patients are often noted to have a contrast-enhancing lesion, which means that when the contrast is administered, it pools or outlines the extent of the lesion. It doesn't give a direct indicator of what the tumor, where the tumor is located. Rather, it's an indirect indicator of where the blood vessels are abnormal around the tumor. And so sometimes the tumor may be eradicated, but the blood vessels are still not normal. And that can give, we believe that can give rise to residual abnormal enhancement signal, which can be concerning to patients. And moreover, the enhancement signal can be confused for other processes as well, and may not be necessarily disease-related, in especially after treatment. There are also changes that are seen that are not related to enhancement, which are oftentimes noted by patients and confused patients in terms of their significance, namely what we call the T2 signal, or flare signals, which persist even after treatment. And this relates to the tissue signal denoted by a T2 method of imaging the protons in the brain. T2 signal can increase independent of the tumor activity by just administration of chemotherapy, such as methotrexate. Even patients without a brain tumor who get some types of chemotherapy, such as 5-fluorouracil, can get T2 changes in their brain without evidence of neurotoxicity. It's just basically a scar from the treatment with very little, if any, clinical consequences, unless it's very severe. So it's important to note that T2 changes do not necessarily mean the tumor is active. It means the patient it means the brain has been exposed to chemotherapy, and it may be fixed and permanent. We also see T2 changes as we age, and they're not considered significant or detrimental to normally to brain health. So that basically closes the main issues I want to talk about with open notes. I think that the other issue is that physicians are often noted to have to describe the neurologic examination. And it's important to note then, of course, that many of the neurologic deficits can be improved upon with exercise and cognitive rehab. So I believe that we're in as we improve with this therapy, there's great optimism for patients to improve their neurocognitive function as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rubenstein. Just a wonderful presentation and just wonderful information for our participants to understand really how to prepare for their appointments with their physician and also the discussion of open notes. So thank you. I'm sure there'll be questions for you as well during the Q&A. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care offers free programs and services to people living with any type of cancer, and with UPDATE, primary central nervous system lymphoma. And we do see a number of patients who do have people who have primary central nervous system lymphoma, so please feel free to contact Cancer Care. You can contact us calling us on our HOPE line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Again, all our services are free, and we provide just really a host of services for people throughout the United States, so that please do take advantage of those services. And now we're going to move on to the question and answer period. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. So I'm going to ask Regina to explain to you how to queue up for questions. I want to take as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
There are quite a few questions here. This is a question for a doctor who is at an increased risk to develop primary central nervous system lymphoma.
Thank you. And this is for me, Dr. Baxter?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a really good question, an insightful question, because there are certain conditions when a person is immunocompromised. And in that immunocompromised state, there is a higher risk of developing primary CNS lymphomas and also some conditions that might not formally be classified as a lymphoma but are lymphoid conditions that can involve the brain. So some of those conditions include organ transplant, so individuals who have had kidney transplants, et cetera, and who are on immune suppressive drugs at our higher risk, are certainly at higher risk of CNS lymphomas, lymphoid disease. Also, human immunodeficiency virus or HIV infection is a risk factor for primary CNS lymphoma. And there are certain genetic conditions, immunocompromised conditions that individuals are born with that lead to a higher risk of developing primary CNS lymphoma.
Thank you so much. And our next question is for Dr. Ren. Is a clinical trial the best treatment option for most patients?
Hi. So I think that's a great question. You know, we always, when we see patients in our clinical practice, we just go over all the options on the table and really try to find out what would be the, you know, best possible option for individual patients. I want to say that we always want to prioritize clinical trials, you know, because they usually have us get access the most cutting edge possibility, whether it was a biological agent that adding to chemotherapy like backbone, or just biological agents alone, testing either inductions or consolidation or maintenance. So that's a great advantage new agents of promise. On the other hand, we also go over what's possibly available current established combinations and agents, you know, because they do come with, longitudinal follow-ups. We know side effects profiles, and sometimes it does give us some flexibility, you know, in terms of doing adjustment. Where in contrast, you know, for the clinical trials, we go over possible uncertainty, right? You know, both in terms of effectiveness and side effects. And also, you know, we're being very carefully monitoring and follow what's, put forth in the clinical trial protocol. So those would be, you know, quite going along with the program and things like that. So I wanting to say that it really is a very individualized case type of situations, and I think to have as much information for an informed discussion and decision making process is the most important. And again, where possible, you know, if it's really looking like, you know, there's a good preliminary evidence and some knowledge of possible side effects and whatnot, you know, we would certainly encourage participation, and especially in cases where, you know, that there are probably limitations of current available established type of treatment options.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And our next question is, how closely are patients monitored after being diagnosed? What should they expect in the follow-up process? Dr. Rosenstein? Dr. Rubenstein?
Sure. Well, it's important that patients follow up closely with their physician to review neurologic symptoms, which may be improving, or if the disease is still active, there may be new signs of recurrent disease that need to be addressed with treatment. Generally, an MRI, a repeat MRI is recommended every few months for generally for the first couple of years, although after the first 2 years, there's likely less need to repeat imaging at that frequency, and it's more dependent upon patient's preference. Some patients are very anxious about their disease recurring and want to have that MRI done. But in general, after the first year or two, it's unlikely that the probability that the disease is going to come back, like systemic aggressive lymphomas, decreases dramatically after 2 years. It's also important that patients have repeat blood tests done, especially after consolidation with bone marrow transplant or non-myeloablative consolidation, because counts can fluctuate and cytopenias may persist and need to be monitored, and patients' immunologic status needs to be monitored for about 4 to 6 months, because the consolidation phase of treatment can be very immunosuppressive. And so patients need to be on prophylactic agents such as antivirals, such as acyclovir, or antibiotics that prevents a pneumonia, such as Bactrim, for a few months after the consolidation phase until the lymphocyte count improves in the blood.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And we're going to ask for our physicians to provide takeaways. So what that means is we'll start with Dr. Ruin. If you could just provide a takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program. So Dr. Ruin, would you go first, please?
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, it's a very, you know, a very special type of condition, like was discussed earlier, that, you know, it may be quite symptomatic at the time of diagnosis, but I want to say that having treated many patients with primary CNS lymphoma, that, you know, the outcome is rather promising and it's only getting better. And so I wanted to say that, you know, to go along with, you know, practice centers or groups that has a lot of experience of treating, diagnosing and treating primary CNS lymphoma with options of, you know, expertise with established care, but also options of availability of clinical trial, and, you know, it's rather promising, and I think that our patients would certainly benefit and have many more years of high quality, life for themselves as well as their family.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ruin. That's excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Batchelor, your takeaway for people on this program today?
Well, I'd largely concur with what was said. I would say I've been in the field now for 25 years, and I've just witnessed a remarkable evolution of better treatments, more efficacious treatments, and better options to manage side effects. So it's really a great time in terms of being able to offer more to our patients and to really have a curative intent in these patients when they come in to see us. And so it's a very, very exciting time for those reasons.
Excellent. Thank you. Very very optimistic and very helpful to everybody on the call. Thank you. And Dr. Rubenstein.
Yeah, I echo what Dr. Baffler just said about optimism. And I think just to reiterate my point, I think it's important to realize that in the first visit, maybe not all the information can be conveyed in great detail. So I think it's important to recognize that the information download and receipt of the information can be provided to the patient as the treatment proceeds. And maybe not all patients are ready to hear about 8 months of treatment at the beginning, but they need to know that they need to have methotrexate-based treatment immediately and what the side effects of that are, and then proceed with the next steps. Some patients are ready to hear everything, but that's not everybody. And it's important that they hear that this is a potentially curable disease, and neurologic improvement and even complete recovery is definitely within reach for many patients.
What a wonderful way to conclude the program. That's excellent. Thank you so much. Really, just I have to say, this is the first time we've offered this particular program, not the last time, however. And I have to say that this has been a remarkable program for the participants as well as for the speakers as well, to have brought together such an amazing group of speakers, first of all. I have to say Dr. John Leonard at Weill Cornell recommended these speakers today, the four speakers that you've heard, and they're the best of the best. And I think the concept of going to a comprehensive center that treats a large number of patients with this type of primary central nervous system lymphoma is so important. I can't stress that enough. I think our speakers have stressed it as well. It's important to go to a comprehensive center that really has a lot of expertise in working with people with primary central nervous system lymphoma. It's very important. I also want to kind of very much support what our speakers have said in terms of really choosing the best of the best in terms of where you go for your care. That's so important. And there are a number of organizations out there to help, and I just want to kind of stress that as well. I also want to stress that it's very important to know when you're going to a physician who is available weekends, evenings, and holidays. That's really important because I think people often run into a lot of difficulty on those particular occasions. So always get the phone numbers of who you should call on those particular occasions. And also be sure that your physicians are available to you so that they certainly usually are available during the day, but weekends, holidays, and evenings, that isn't always the case. And so it's very important to know who to go to. Again, I just really want to thank everybody for your participation today. I also want to mention that we have over 130 participants on today's program, and you come from all over the world, from Canada, Ghana, Ireland, Japan, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this last hour and, an hour and more than an hour, actually, with us on today's program. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.